Call the Commerce Consumer Protection Committee to order. Now that Representative Lesch has entered the room, we've got a couple of Representative Lesch's bills at the top of the calendar, House File 694. The Chair will move that House File 694 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. And it's my understanding, Representative Lesch, you have an A1 amendment? Is that an author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And then the Chair will move the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Lesch, to your bill as amended.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I have Ron Elwood here with me who can walk through it, if that's all right, the Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesch. Mr. Elwood, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Would like me to explain the amendment or the bill?
It's already, you don't need to explain the amendment. Explain the bill as amended.
As amended. Okay, great. This is a bill that modifies our existing debt settlement and debt management laws. The reason it's before you, we have a very good statute in Minnesota regarding these two practices. They had come under severe scrutiny over the years for some very abusive practices. This legislature has, in 07 and 09, passed legislation that has created a very good set of consumer protections while allowing these businesses to take place. There are a couple of things, though, over the years that have popped up, and this bill attempts to resolve them. The first one is there is a, when the bill was passed back in 09, the intent of the bill with respect to the attorney exemption was to make it pretty clear that essentially if you're in the business of debt settlement, if that's your principal and exclusive practice, follow the law. If you're an attorney who does debt settlement or debt management, just as one of a portfolio of things, then of course you don't have to follow all the rules. The rules are not that onerous. There needs to be a there's a requirement to do some sort of a preliminary analysis to see if this response to your debt is appropriate, making sure that the folks who you're going to be negotiating with maybe 1 or 2 years down the road will actually play ball with you, so consumers will know if they should pay the money. There is a set of protections regarding when money is collected, fees are collected, and how much can be collected, and of course if there are some basic prohibitions and contract requirements. So the attorney exception had been in place, and the intent, because I can tell you that this is a fact because I was here and I was one of the proponents of the bill. So the intent was essentially if you're in the business, you're in as an attorney. If you're not, you're out. And the amendment that's before you amends the underlying bill to make it even clearer and more tight to allow attorneys or not sweep in attorneys who really aren't in the business. We're trying to really make it tight, and that's what this does. The second part of the bill extends the FTC's advance fee ban, which was put in place a couple of years ago, basically saying you got to do the work before you get paid. The reason it needs to be in Minnesota law is because under the FTC rule, it only applies to a transaction solicited through an interstate telephone call. And most of these are over the Internet, so it only applies very sparingly. I will say that this bill you should have in your packets letters of support from the AARP and from Lutheran Social Service, which has is very active with debtors and has seen the abuses of the folks trying to skirt the law, and they are all in support of this bill. We have talked to the bankers and the various stakeholders in Minnesota. There's nobody from that side of the fence that's opposed. So we really appreciate your support and stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. There are others that desire to be heard with respect to House File 694. I do have one individual on the list who is Carrie Petty. Or Mr. Ruther.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to address you on this legislation. My name is Neil Reuther, and I'm the managing member of Purcell & Associates, which is a national law firm that represents people who are in irremediable credit card and other unsecured debt problems. We have been providing unbundled legal services for over 15 years to the population of people who generally cannot afford traditional representation by attorneys because it is simply too expensive. With me is Ms. Carrie Petty, who is one of our staff attorneys here in the state of Minnesota. My problem with this bill is that it goes about a laudable goal in the wrong way and will wind up in the long run hurting consumers. When we represent a consumer who is in debt, unlike a debt settlement company who can hire anybody to give a consumer advice about what they should and shouldn't do, people with no more training than a high school education, we make sure by consultation with attorneys that all of the possible legal implications of their attempting a common law composition with their creditors, and that's what this is, it's nothing more than a bankruptcy reorganization outside the protection of the bankruptcy court, to make sure that all of the legal implications, and there are dozens and dozens of them, have been considered before a consumer goes down the road of trying to compromise the debts and avoid a bankruptcy. More importantly, if the consumer is harassed by creditors, we pursue Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act actions against them. If the consumer cannot afford to go into a program like this, we wind up providing bankruptcy for them. If the consumer is judgment-proof, and that is a very technical legal judgment, we provide very low-cost services to them designed to protect them from collection efforts by their creditors and persuade their creditors that they are judgment-proof and that the judgment or that the debt should be written off. None of these services are provided by debt settlement companies, and that's what you as this legislature started out to try to regulate. What is it that we're going to require a non-lawyer debt settlement company to say? What is it we're going to require them to do? What standards are we going to set up for them? Well, lawyers already have those standards. We are far better regulated, far better educated, far better capable of adequately, indeed excellently, representing consumers' interests in this kind of work. The problem that my colleague Mr. Elwood seeks to ameliorate is a real one. A lawyer who simply goes out and says, well, I'm an attorney, but I'm not going to provide any legal services to someone. I'm going to sign on the dotted line, and I'm going to thereby run a business that has nothing to do with the practice of law, and I'm going to avoid all of the protections that the legislature has enacted for people who are non-lawyers doing this kind of work. Well, I agree, that should be stopped. But doing what you're about to do or what this bill is asking you to do is not the way to do it. Why would you want to enact a piece of legislation that says people who are most experienced at this, and we have hundreds of thousands of data points of what creditors, any given creditor, will and will not do because of the fact that we do so much of this, why would you want to act a piece of legislation that says you who are experienced at this cannot do it, but people who only do it occasionally and therefore don't have the skill or experience to do it well are treated differently? Our firm also keeps its costs very low by acquiring services from non-lawyer companies that don't relate to the practice of law itself. We buy administrative services, people answering the phones, people doing treasury management, people sometimes negotiating as paralegals with creditors. The mere fact that we purchase those services, which are delivered under our supervision, would exempt us from the qualifications of this statute. Now, why, you say, can't you simply abide by the statute? It's a good question. The reason for that is you cannot expect law firms to charge in the same fee structure that a company that does not have to pay lawyers to give out good, competent legal advice or fight FDCPA cases, or file pleadings in court, or answer discovery, or file discovery in order to defeat claims by creditors, to charge the same thing as a non-lawyer company is charging. This is not a level playing field, ladies and gentlemen. It is a skewed playing field when you permit non-lawyers to do this at all. So that the rules with respect to what a lawyer can charge, which are very specific and are regulated by your Supreme Court, are the only rules that this committee and this legislature really need to look to in governing what lawyers can charge. So how do you cure the evil that this bill was designed to stop? It's simple. You pass a law, very much like the uniform law enacted by the Uniform Council of Commissioners on Uniform Laws, that says in order for a lawyer to be exempt from this regulation, he or she has to have a license to practice law, has to engage in a lawyer-client relationship, and that's a term of art that means something, and actually has to render legal services. If you do those three things, you already have an elaborate regulatory scheme that is perfectly capable of stopping abuses. This bill is going to prevent law firms like mine from offering a higher quality service at a low price to consumers that they desperately need. I've taken enough of your time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Ruther. That was helpful. I should ask, is there anybody else who desires to testify with respect to the bill? Okay. Questions or concerns from members? Otherwise, I'm going to go back to Representative Lesh here. But, okay. Representative Lesh, anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I would merely note in closing that the attorney loophole provision that we had last year was supported by the Debt Settlement Industry Trade Association, the American Fair Credit Council. Representative Mazzarel carried that bill, and the industry had its own bill last year, and the FTC fee ban was included in it. So with that, members, I would just ask your support. Vote yes. I think it's a reasonable provision, and ask for support.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Thank you, Mr. Ruther, and
thank you,
Mr. Elwood. Are there, unless there's additional questions or testimony, seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 694, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, same sign. See none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Lesh. Stick in that chair because you've also got 642. The chair will move that House File 642. Be recommended pass and refer to the General Register. Representative Lesh, to House File 642.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For 27 years, Minnesota followed the common practice throughout the states, which is to establish a private attorney general free fee recoupment for individuals who sued under provisions that were allowed to be pursued by the Attorney General under Chapter 8 of Minnesota statutes. What that means is if you have specifically a claim such as a consumer fraud claim and the Attorney General is understaffed, is not able to pursue this, you can hire private counsel, and that private counsel, if you prevail, can get the fees from the defendant who defrauded you, but it's only if you prevail. A Supreme Court opinion around about 10 years ago decided that no, you had to establish a public purpose separately in this, and the Supreme Court decision held that virtually nothing can be shown to be a public purpose. You essentially have to qualify under the standard certification process of a class action, which is very, very difficult. So it dried up the opportunities of many people to obtain justice for consumer fraud claims in the state of Minnesota. Members, we are only one of only a handful of states of about four that have the public benefit exception, and none of the states are as broad and as encompassing as Minnesotans. In every other state but one, individuals, namely family farmers and small businesses, to whom this is probably most relevant, can sue when defrauded under consumer protection laws. But the Supreme Court's rule make us the outlier. In many states, we have treble damages. So if you're a farmer or a small business person and a seed company defrauds you with respect to a bill or something, you can sue and get three times your amount of damages. We're not even looking for that in Minnesota. We're simply looking to be recouped the costs that we have in order to achieve justice in this state. All the talk about all the bad things that are going to happen is belied by the fact that every other state has the system we're trying to restore, and it had worked just fine right here in the state of Minnesota, in your hometown, for 27 years. The other thing is that the Supreme Court has never been able to identify any ambiguity in the statute supporting its decision. The reason for the Supreme Court's decision was they essentially read language into the statute that wasn't there. So the effort of this bill is to make it indelibly clear to the Supreme Court that we mean what we originally said we meant, and that worked fine here in Minnesota for 27 years. So I'd ask for member support.
Thank you, Representative Lesch. I've got a couple folks who signed up to testify, Chris Renz and Kate Johansson.
Oh, actually, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
I've got a testifier here that I didn't think I'd have.
Sounds so good, Representative Lesch.
Can he testify?
Hopefully they're testifying on behalf of your bill.
Can you testify on behalf of me? Yes, he is.
I'd be happy
Chair.
To have him testify. Thank you. If you'll just identify who you are and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Prentice Cox. I'm Associate Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota. Prior to that, I was the manager of the Consumer Enforcement Division at the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, including at the time in 2000 this Supreme Court decision was handed down. I'll just have two very quick points. I think Representative Lesch laid out the territory beautifully. Number one, in 2006, 6 years after the decision was passed, I did a comprehensive study of all the cases that have been decided at that point, and I have followed the case law since then, and I just want to make sure everyone understands exactly what happened. Individuals and family farmers, and by the way, family farmers are active users of this statute until this decision was passed, promulgated. Individuals and family farmers have been completely excluded from the courts as a result of this decision. Business plaintiffs sometimes make it through. Class actions make it through, and joinder plaintiffs, meaning groups of plaintiffs, can get together and make it through. Individuals and family farmers have had the courthouse door barred. This is not consistent with the language of the statute. The court, in a recent decision, simply gave up trying to find any ambiguity in the statute, and its decision essentially read, that's the law because we said it was the law 13 years ago. It is also inconsistent with the purpose of the statute, which is to provide access to justice for consumers who have been defrauded. There's absolutely no rationale for excluding individuals and family farmers from having access to the courts when business plaintiffs and class actions have that access. Secondly, I just want to emphasize the point about the extent to which Minnesota is an outlier here. This is not a bill about whether lawsuits are good or bad. This is a bill about who has access to bring lawsuits in the courts. Minnesota's current law makes it the most restrictive law in the nation, arguably. One study by the National Consumer Law Center concluded that in Minnesota, it's virtually impossible for individuals to bring a lawsuit. So the question isn't whether lawsuits are good or bad. The question is whether Minnesota should have a rule that puts it outside of the mainstream, or whether Minnesota should come back to where it was before the decision by the Supreme Court was handed down in 2000 and bring Minnesota back into the mainstream. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Next up is either Chris Renz or Kate Johansson. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Renz. I'm an attorney at Thompson Nybeck, counsel to the Minnesota Association of Realtors and its 17,000 members in your state, and which is also itself a member of the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform, testifying in opposition to House File 642 for three primary reasons that I'll try and go through briefly with you. One is that it's an unnecessary law and contrary to the Attorney General statute. Secondly, it's harmful to realtors and other small businesses. And three, it's inherently unfair. First, it's unnecessary and contrary to the Attorney General statute. This is a solution for a problem that simply doesn't exist. Under the current state of the law, judges can and do determine that when a case is in the public interest and there's a prevailing party, attorney's fees are awarded. The Minnesota Supreme Court closely examined the statute in its 2000 decision, which has already been referenced, and found that. The statute, as its title suggests, allows a private citizen to stand in the shoes of the Attorney General. Just as a citizen wouldn't pay attorney's fees if the Attorney General's office was pursuing a claim, so also the statute allows recoupment of attorney's fees if the individual spends those fees in the Attorney General's shoes. But the problem is that the Attorney General doesn't pursue private interests. I would ask this committee to specifically look at Minnesota Statute 801. The Attorney General appears in civil cases where the interests of the state require it. This amendment fails to recognize the important distinction between what the Attorney General does, which is have the public for its client and the public good, versus an individual litigant and their own attorney. Making every Consumer Fraud Act claim one in which a claimant stands in the shoes of the Attorney General's office isn't true to the concept of the Attorney General statute. If a misrepresentation isn't made to the public, it is not in the public interest for pursuit of that. If every Consumer Fraud Act claim was defined as being in the public benefit, which is what House File 642 tries to do, in the words of the Lee decision, every artful counsel could dress up his dogpipe case, and then they would threaten defendants with attorney's fees. Claimants already have redress. If it's a public benefit, the courts allow them their attorney's fees under the public benefit case. And there are plenty of decisions, including, I'd point specifically to Collins versus Minnesota School of Business, where that's been held. If it's not a public benefit, they have their private causes of action that they can pursue. And in addition to all of that, there is recoupment by criminal enforcement and the restitution therefrom. So first, it's unnecessary and it's contrary to the purpose of the Attorney General statute. Second, and probably most importantly to this committee as the Commerce Committee, the proposed law creates problems, particularly for realtors and the real estate industry. I have litigated cases regarding real estate agent and broker liability in the state for over a decade, and I can tell you that there is already a sentiment of sue every real estate agent involved in the transaction if there's a problem, because there's a belief that there will be insurance money brought to the table. This legislation only puts more blood in the water. Realtors already have to pay money to settle unfounded lawsuits in order to avoid their own litigation fees. But this exacerbates that problem. Misguided plaintiffs' attorneys bringing suit against everyone involved will only increase with the allure of attorney's fees. Contingency fee attorneys will make this worse. While plaintiffs can initiate suit without personal exposure when it's brought on a contingency, which is the kind of suits that will then be brought, those who have to defend against it, the individuals and small businesses of the real estate community, they don't get a defense on contingency. That's money that they have to come up with and defend against these lawsuits. The prospect of an increase in the litigation, if every Consumer Fraud Act claim is made in the public benefit, which is what you're being asked to do, is real. The Consumer Fraud Act claim is much broader than a common law action for fraud. It's construed more broadly, and as a result, this law would shift the standing American rule, and the American rule is the default, and it requires everybody to pay their own attorney's fees, for nearly every claim against which realtors and other individuals and small businesses have to defend. I'd like to make sure that there are two impressions that you don't have because of misimpressions. One, to the extent you think that realtors are not going to be harmed personally because they have insurance coverage, I can tell you that that's a fallacy. Most insurance policies have an exception for attorney's fees. So this will hurt individuals and small businesses that are your constituents. Second, attorney's fees and this provision are not only a consideration if there is ultimate success in the litigation, which I think has been suggested by its proponents, because it ignores the modern litigation context, which is nothing goes to trial. This is about leverage, and what you're doing, and I'll get to in a second as my third point, I'll try and wrap up, is you are giving unfair leverage to one side of this equation. So secondly, it is harmful to realtors, and there will be an increase in nuisance lawsuits harming this community. Third, this creates an unfair playing field. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this creates all upside for the claimant. They recover their fees if they win, but they are not required to pay the attorney's fees to the defendant if the claimant loses. This rubric incentivizes weak and unfounded claims on an already strained judiciary. Like I said, the default's the American rule. What you are doing by virtue of this legislation is giving only one side the advantage, and that's not leveling the playing field. If you want to create an exception to the American rule, that's fair, then the loser pays. That way, anybody who shouldn't have been there pays. But that's not what this does. This proposed law only changes it for one side. And what it does is, by paying attention to one side, it ignores the crippling effect of nuisance suits that are often against individuals and small businesses. So thirdly, the proposed law is unfair. I'd respectfully ask, Mr. Chair, that this committee not pass this bill. It's unnecessary, it's harmful to realtors and other small businesses, and it's inherently unfair. Thank you.
Thank you. And the final testifier I had was Ms. Johansson. As far as signed up on the list, welcome back.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much. My name is Kate Johansson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and its 2,400 members, 80% of which are small businesses. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Unfortunately, we oppose this House file for a few simple reasons. First is policy. The second is its impact on business, especially small business. And the third is the record of this type of policy in other states. With respect to the first point of policy, I think that it's important to note that this legislation would be overturning common law, and it would also be overturning the Levy-Nystrom case of earlier, about a decade ago, of the Minnesota Supreme Court. In that case, the court interpreted whether or not the private attorney general statute should be extended to every private fraud action. And they said that there was no way that the legislature could intend to sweep every private dispute based on fraud under the Consumer Fraud Act into the Private Attorney General's Act, because attorney's fees and added costs and allowing them to be collected by in that type of dispute would be contrary to common law as we know it. That's not the American system of jurisprudence. Generally, people pay for their own attorney's fees, except in very unusual cases. So certainly, as a legislature, it is your decision as to whether or not you want to overturn that precedent and want to take up a position that is contrary to common law, but you would also want to think very carefully about doing that, because you're carving a huge exception out that a lot of people and a lot of businesses rely on. The second most important point, frankly, is the impact that this legislation would have on businesses, and this is something that a lot of our members care about. The bottom line is that this legislation would increase frivolous lawsuits, and it would, frankly, increase costs that would be passed along to consumers. When there is no risk for a plaintiff to bring a suit, but there is huge expense for a business in defending it, that doesn't result in good public policy. In this case, a plaintiff would receive attorney's fees and costs if they won a suit, but a defendant, a small business, for example, would not receive attorney's fees if they won, and even if they win, they will still have to spend up to tens of thousands of dollars defending these cases. That's not a good public policy, and that brings me to my final point, which is that we've seen negative results with similar public policy along these lines in other states. A classic example comes from a small dry cleaner in Washington, D.C., that actually had an action under this type of law brought against it, won the case, but went out of business because it couldn't afford the attorney's fees that it incurred in defending itself, even though it won. And we've also seen that this type of law has been overturned by public referendum in California because of the deleterious effects that this type of legislation has had on small businesses. So with those points in mind, I'd really like to request that you oppose this legislation respectfully, and I'd be happy to take your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johansson. Is there anyone else who desires to testify? And then we do have a question or two for members. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for both Ms. Johansson and Mr. Renz, I'm glad you gave that example here on the dry cleaner. We had an actual informational hearing here of Representative Pepin's bill talking about how this company wasn't allowed to use their family name as part of their products, and they were being sued by a much larger corporation, and they couldn't afford their legal fees, and they're basically at the point where they're having to lay off people in order to keep going on that. And I'm concerned about is it possible that under this proposed law, a competitor of yours could keep suing you through individuals, you know, they could keep suing you to the point that you would just have to go out of business because of the legal fees that you would incur?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't see anything in this law that would preclude that, so certainly I think it is possible. I'm an attorney, but I'm not giving legal advice. They teach us to say that in law school. But I would also say that that is possible, and a lot of small businesses are concerned not only about that situation, but even just common situations where a frivolous case is brought, and when it's fraud, it's a lot of he said, she said, and those cases often go to trial, and they take a lot of time and money to resolve, and that impacts directly that business's ability to meet their financial solvency goals and their ability to retain workers. So yes, it is possible that it could be used as a harassment tool by competitors, but it also is just bad public policy, I think, fundamentally.
Representative Anderson?
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Are there other questions? Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think a fiscal note has been requested on this. Is that right, Representative Lesh?
Well, I hope
Representative Lesh.
Well, I mean, the question is revolving around.
I believe it has been recorded.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, I think it has, yes.
And Representative right. Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesh, I assume that it would have an impact on the courts, correct?
Representative Lesh?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Woodard, remember, this is the Private Attorney General statute. It means to the extent that any new claims are made by a private citizen, it alleviates work on the part of the Attorney General. So I would think that if there is increase borne by the courts, they would be more than offset by the alleviation on the Attorney General.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. And it's an interesting topic, Representative Woodard. It's just not in the jurisdiction of this committee. So if you have other questions, you're more than happy to share them.
I do, and I'll try to make sure they are in the jurisdiction of the committee. Thank you. The other piece, then, is what about what would be the threshold for whether or not a frivolous lawsuit is not in the public interest? So, I mean, can you kind of walk through what would be considered in the public interest and what isn't?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, that was language that was crafted by the attorney or by the Supreme Court in 2000 in Levy and Nystrom. So that was what they decided. As it happens, since then, virtually nothing is in the public interest. By virtue of the fact that the Attorney General brings suit, then presumably it is in the public interest because they are paid by the taxpayers. But other than that, that's the only threshold. But for the 27 years where this worked successfully in the state of Minnesota, it was if you brought suit under the sections of statute over which the Attorney General had jurisdiction, namely what we're talking about here is consumer fraud.
Representative Woodard?
And then one final follow-up
sure.
question,
Representative
Mr. Chair.
Woodard.
So how often is it that we pass laws that would then overturn a Minnesota Supreme Court ruling? I mean, is that, I'm not aware of any, so I'm just curious whether this is a common practice, something we do very often?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, yes. I think we do it all the time up here. I mean, the Supreme Court, for example, does the same thing. They create a payables list, which overrules the legislature's decisions on what we said as crimes in the state of Minnesota. They decriminalize de facto. And then we side, no, the Supreme Court got it wrong. In fact, my last committee in judiciary, Representative Simon, brought a bill about statute of limitations because the Supreme Court wrote regarding child sex abuse language into the statute that most people agree was not there. So I think we do it pretty frequently, Ron.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call vote on this as well.
Go ahead. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't recall. What's the motion? Are we sending this to judiciary? To
At this point, it's heading to the General Register. If they if there's a fiscal note that has an impact, they'd be welcome to ask for it on the floor.
That's what I was wondering. And then question for Hoppe. Representative Lesh. I'm not an attorney, Representative Lesh. I don't. And maybe things would work out really well. I don't see how we can pass this and not have a lot more lawsuits. And I think we would have more lawsuits in the courts, and I think we would at least have the potential. I know people are generally and inherently good, but there's at least the potential out there that people would file what we like to call frivolous lawsuits because they could. So, I, Representative Lesh, I guess I don't really have a question. I just... I don't know that this is something that we want to be doing. I think for the Commerce Committee perspective, I don't see how this is good for, I know the realtors testified, but I don't see how this is good for business in general. And I would urge members to vote no with all due respect, Representative Lesh.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Members, Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I think there is, it's difficult to wrap your head around this in some senses, and I do get that, I understand that, but members, talk to some of your local small businesses, because absolutely, this is a bill that is geared towards small business and not big business. Think who is at a disadvantage with respect to negotiating and who would be put in a better position on this bill. It would be small business. They're the ones that are going to benefit most greatly from this. Mr. Chair, members, no, someone could not sue you over and over, Representative Anderson, any more than they already could and put you out of business. Absolutely not. They have to pay their own fees. And the requirements, as Representative Woodard had asked, the requirements, the only lawsuits that are permissible on this under which you could recoup your fees are those which are already permissible to be for claims to be made by the Attorney General, specifically consumer fraud. So the statement that every private fraud claim would now be subject to fee shifting, no. Members, you have to win. You have to win first. That's why this jurisdiction is the area of the Attorney General, because we're talking about consumer fraud. We're not talking about your run-of-the-mill contract dispute or your copyright dispute. We're talking about consumer fraud, which is codified in Minnesota statutes as criminal. If you can meet the bar, which is high, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. This is criminal behavior, which is really tough to prove. So we have a civil cause of action for it. And if you win on that, okay, we're going to give you fees as well. But no, members, not every dog bite case is suddenly going to be the purview in the province of the Attorney General. The Attorney General of the state of Minnesota does not have jurisdiction over your neighbor's chihuahua, even if it's an ill-tempered chihuahua. It can't do it. It can't do it. So, members, I'd ask for your yes vote. This is absolutely very reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Representative Anderson, and then the chair has just one clarifying point, and then we're going to vote. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesh, you shouldn't have said my name. You know, tax rule. If you get your name mentioned, you get a chance to speak. What my concern with this bill, Representative Lesh, is the fact that we are going to see small businesses in particular that are going to get hurt by this, because as you've got this written right now, a small business owner, they have the choice of this. They're going to settle at $10,000 or they're going to face $60,000 in attorney fees that they'll never be able to recoup even when they do win. So as we've heard here today, even if they win, they're not going to be able to recoup their costs from the person that filed the suit in the first place. And my concern with that is, well, that's a huge burden that we're going to have, and I think the people that are going to see a windfall from this are the attorneys. And so we're going to see a lot of our businesses that are going to be on the hook, and I can also see them being targets of competitors, big and small, who can see this as an opportunity of, hey, the economy's tight anyway. If I just give them one more lawsuit, this will squeeze them out of the marketplace. So I don't know if this is really helpful in our going climate and what it will do to our small businesses. So I would ask that you would reconsider your legislation, but thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And just one clarifying point that it's modest, but I think it's important, and that is in Minnesota we still do have a rule that if you bring a frivolous lawsuit, that the party against whom that frivolous lawsuit is brought has the ability to collect attorney's fees from the party who brought the frivolous lawsuit. And I just noted that that piece had not been brought up yet, but that's kind of important. With that, the clerk will call, roll call having been requested. House File 642 has recommended, the chair will renew his motion that House File 642 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Roll call having been requested. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Poppy?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Anzelt?
Yes.
Davids?
No.
Dean?
Aye.
Falk?
Aye.
Halverson?
Aye.
Hillstrom? Hortman?
Aye.
Johnson?
Yes.
Lilly?
Aye.
Loon?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Schoen?
Aye.
Slocum?
Aye.
Sundin?
Aye.
Svedzinski?
No.
Tice?
No.
Woodard?
No.
And Zellers?
Just not here.
The final tally being 12 in favor, 8 opposed. The motion prevails. Representative Lesch, House File 642 is passed and sent to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Lesch and members. Next up, we've got the minutes of the March 19th meeting. Representative Johnson will move those minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, seeing none, that motion carries. The Chair will move House File 1030, Representative Paymar's bill. Be recommended pass and refer to the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. Representative Paymar, it's my understanding that you have an author's amendment, the 813-0284. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Chair will move the 813-284 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Paymar, welcome to the committee. We look forward to hearing your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just to real briefly, back in 1996, the Minnesota Legislature created the Auto Theft Prevention Program. And this program was funded and is funded from a surcharge that is collected from the automobile insurance carriers, those who provide comprehensive insurance coverage issued in the state of Minnesota. Over the years, Mr. Chair, and especially back, trying to remember, in 2002, when this legislature, some of you were here, not many of you, but some of you were here, when we faced a $4.5 billion budget deficit in 2002, then Governor Tim Pawlenty and the legislature agreed to direct that half of this surcharge be appropriated to the general fund. You know, I think back then, as I don't think having served back then, I know that this was something that was a practice where we were raiding very special revenue funds. I felt at the time, and I think many of us did, that that was an unethical practice because this money was not going for the purposes that it was designed for, and that was for auto theft. So this bill corrects that and ensures that the money gets used for its purposes, and it creates two more funds related to that that deal with the prosecution and investigation of insurance fraud, as well as and provides an additional $100,000 for crime victims who find themselves victims of auto theft. With that, Mr. Chair, I know that some of that's not in the purview to this committee, but I would like my testifiers, Ramsey County Attorney Choi, and I have others, Mr. Hasse, and a whole slew of law enforcement. But we can
Representative
limit that.
Paymar, we want to hear from each and every one of them later this evening when none of us are here.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. I appreciate their taking the time to be here. Are you aware of any opposition to this bill, Representative Paymar?
No. In fact, it's supported by law enforcement, the insurance industry, and probably most Minnesotans. They knew that this was occurring, but. If you could just allow the Ramsey County Attorney to give maybe a minute of
and Representative Paymar, that was my thinking too. We're happy to hear from anybody that wants to be heard, but we've got the County Attorney from Ramsey County, Mr. Choi. If you'd be kind enough to provide a little testimony and support, and then we'll go from there. Mr. Choi, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here in support of this effort to return the $1.3 million back into this account and also to expand that account to use it for not only auto theft but also for insurance fraud. Just as it relates to auto theft, this money from the law enforcement community that are here, we benefit greatly from this. And even despite the fact that the money has been cut, this fund has proven its worth because the results have been very good. And just going back to a high water mark in 2005 in the state of Minnesota, we had 14,249 auto thefts. In 2010, it was 8,398. And a lot of that has to do with some of the good efforts that are funded through these grants through the Minnesota Department of Commerce. So on behalf of a lot of the people that are here today, I know that we strongly support this, and it will have, I think, because it's proven its worth, I think we could even make a bigger and better outcomes as it relates to helping crime victims of auto theft and also holding those people that perpetrate this crime accountable.
Thank you, Mr. Choi. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize if this was said earlier. I was kind of looking through some of the notes here on the legislation. Is the $1.3 million Representative Paymar, is that what's completely in the Auto Theft Prevention Fund, or is that just a portion of it that was transferred over?
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that is a portion of the money that it was by law. It goes into the general fund, so it's $2.6 million over the biennium that goes into the general fund and from your insurance surcharge.
Representative Anderson.
So, Mr. Chair, so how much is in the Auto Theft Prevention Fund altogether?
To the extent, Representative Paymar, do you have that figure handy?
I have, there is a current balance in there as of today, I believe. There's someone from the Department of Commerce. Maybe why don't you have them?
All right, Mr. Brickwitty, welcome back.
I can't have my glasses on.
You want me to hold that a little? If you want to hand that to me, Representative Paymar, I could hold it several feet away. And we're both getting about that age, aren't we, Michael? Mr. Brickwitty, welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwitty from the Department of Commerce, Representative Paymar. Let me see if I can help you out a little bit. Representative, to the question about the balance in the account, the balance as of February 28th was $3.85 million with encumbrances of $2.675 million. The $1.3 million that's transferred to the general fund for fiscal year 13 has not yet occurred, and there is still some revenue for this fiscal year anticipated to come in. We anticipate having an ending balance at the end of the fiscal year of about $675,000, which is right about where we want it to be in terms of cash flow for the account as we do administer grants across fiscal years.
Representative Anders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brickwitty, if I remember correctly, when this occurred, I think it happened because they were running a surplus in the fund, and it kind of looks like you are running a surplus here in the fund. I understand that you have the $2.67 million as encumbered, but why would we go this route, and instead, why wouldn't we give a chance to folks to maybe get a break on their insurance? And maybe Representative Paymar, you could speak to that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymar.
All I know is that this fund has not been utilized as much as it can be, and I think that the sheriffs and the law enforcement prosecutors would say that if the word got out there that these funds were available for auto theft prevention, that these grants would be better utilized.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, during the last biennium, the Department of Commerce actually put more money in the two-year cycle into the field through grants than had ever been granted out before from the program. That is in large part because there was a one-time payment into the account by one insurance company that had been previously under reporting had not been reporting their proper funds into the account, and so there was a one-time payment of over $1 million into the account. So we worked very diligently and issued three cycles of RFPs over the last 2 years to get that money granted out to law enforcement agencies. And so we do maintain a balance, as I indicated, in this account for cash flow purposes so that we can make sure that we don't run dry as we go across from one biennial budget to another. So there is a small surplus there, but again, it's not... our intention is to get this money out into the field.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brickwitty, could you do me a favor? Can you look over the last 5 years and send to me who were the grant recipients over the last 5 years, how much was in the fund total, and then also can you give me a list of who is included in the $2.67 million that's encumbered currently? And if you could just email that to me, I think that would be really helpful.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, we can provide
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. And some of this, just members already know this, I think, but some of this discussion is actually in the Public Safety Committee. The finance part of this bill goes there. The philosophy is before the Commerce Committee. which is essentially should we keep the money and spend the money where it was what it was raised for. The member from Lyon.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My question kind of goes back. We had a conversation in this committee talking about kind of bailing out some of the retirement funds because of uninsured folks that are maybe used to carry insurance, seeing 25% of vehicles on the road. Has this account been affected by the same issuance? Would we see larger numbers if we were to get insured back up to numbers maybe we were previously historically or not?
Representative Kimmer, if you know.
I don't know the answer to that.
All right. We'll find an answer for you. I think I know the person to ask. Okay. That's a good question. And then, I'm sorry.
And then one more question. Just and then can obviously the Commerce Department receives applications from police.
Mr. Chair, the money Kimmer. That money, if I'm correct, is transferred to the for the program for the auto goes to the Office of Justice Programs, which is administered through the Department of Public Safety. They then review the competitive grants and make those grants available to prosecutors, victim services, law enforcement. I do think, however, if we've got the information out, this money would be better used.
Okay.
And you know, Representative Anderson, quite frankly, you may be right. You know, if it's not being used, then we shouldn't be taking it from people's insurance policies and not using it for its intended purposes.
Okay. We've got Representative Loon, Representative Davidson. We're going to vote. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief because a lot of my questions were already addressed. But I guess wondering, Mr. Brickwoody mentioned that, you know, a balance was kept just to keep some money in the account. And I guess I'm wondering about that. Why wouldn't we just transfer all of the money that comes in every year over to
Mr. Brickwoody,
the Department of Justice or Public Safety or whoever is holding it for the grants?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, apologies. We maintain a small balance to cash flow the account across biennial budgets. And the reason for that is because there's a competitive grant process. So, for example, in the last RFP cycle, I think there was over $1.2 million in requests that were not fulfilled for either the original request not being deemed to be part of applicable to this fund or because it is a competitive grant process that's highly sought after. I think that the rationale for maintaining that balance is, again, to make sure that the payments are able to continually be made to our grant recipients across the biennial budget because their cycle doesn't necessarily line up with the biennial budget system here.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Brickwoody, so what is that amount that's withheld for cash flow purposes?
Mr. Brickwoody?
I believe it's in the range of $600,000, as I indicated, and I have to pull it up on my iPad. I can give you the exact amount of what we're estimated to be at the end of FY13 afterwards, if you'd like.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what would that be as a percentage of what annually comes in? Is it about 20% or
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, it depends year to year because there it's not a static amount that comes into the account every year because it's as previously testified to 50 cents on every 6 months of insurance coverage that's sold. So depending on what amount of insurance is sold in the state of Minnesota during any particular year, that percentage could vary. But I believe it is significantly less than that.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and finally, so are individuals within the Department of Commerce that are receiving the grant requests and making those determinations, or is it another agency?
Mr. Brickwoody.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, yes, the Department of Commerce administers the program.
Thank you. Well,
Representative Loon.
Thank you, and I think to Representative Paymar's comments, I would agree. If this has been in place for 9 years, if we're not able to get the money out the door, and I guess I don't understand why law enforcement wouldn't know that it's available if it's something they felt they needed. So, looking forward to having Representative Anderson's information, the information she requested. But I think, if we're not using this, we ought to stop charging consumers for it.
Mr. Chair, I apologize Kimmer. For misspeaking too on who had oversight over the grant money.
Okay. Representative David's final word. Our question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in 1996, I believe this bill became law, and I believe I was
an author of it with Representative Mary Jo McGuire, I believe. And there was tremendous opposition from certain sectors of the state to do this, but we moved forward on a bipartisan basis. And it just shows that from time to time there are good things that can happen when you put surcharges and designate them for certain things, such as, let's say, volunteer firefighters' pensions and such. That being said, I'm supporting the Paymar bill today. It might be a discussion for another day if we should even have it. Has it done the job? Has it done what we wanted to do? But we went through some very tough times in the early 2000s, and we were grabbing money out of any account we could possibly find. But I think the situation the state's in right now, that we should support the Paymar bill to get this money for its original intended purpose, and then have the debate another day if that purpose is still worthy. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. The chair will renew his motion that House File 1030 as amended be recommended pass and refer to the Committee on Public Safety Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Paymar. Representative Kelly, I know you were here. Come on down. The chair will move. Well, I guess we'll let Representative Hoppe move. Well,
Mr. Chair, while he's coming down, I'm wondering, have we killed a bill yet this year?
Oh, several.
Yeah, I've got one coming up.
we're waiting.
It ain't looking good.
We got a whole slew of David's bills that we're going to put up any minute now.
It's coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 1000.
Thank you. And Representative Kelly, it's my understanding you've got an A1 author's amendment. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and actually what we're trying to do is get the language to match up with the Senate. And once you know, just this morning the Senate decided in their wisdom to change the language. Once again, I'm wondering if you would take an oral amendment to the A1 amendment.
Well, that's up to the author of the or the mover of the A1 amendment. I don't know. Representative Hoppe, are you interested in that?
No, it's kind of late in the day.
I think that's an excellent idea, Mr. Chair.
I will
move the amendment and the oral amendment.
And we might want to identify what that oral amendment is, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to note it's your members keeping you here, not this table. In line 1.2 on the amendment, deleting where it says page 1, delete that whole line 1.2. 1.3 stays as such, says delete briefly and insert clearly. But after 2.5, language would say effective date, paragraph B, is effective for assessments for state fiscal years commencing after July 1st, 2013.
All right. One more time, Representative Kelly.
To the bill?
One more time on the oral amendment, please.
Okay. After 2.5, effective date, period. Paragraph B is effective for assessments for state fiscal years commencing after July 1st, 2013.
Does our staff have that? Not yet. One more time, Representative Kelly. When you're doing an oral amendment, you got to talk a little slower. Otherwise, we're going to make you keep repeating it. So one more time.
Mr. Chair, effective date, period. Paragraph B is effective for assessments for state fiscal years commencing after July 1st, 2013.
Perfect. The maker of the motion of the A1 amendment incorporates that into his motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Kelly, are you aware of any opposition to your bill?
I am not, Mr. Chair.
All right. That should tell you something, Representative Kelly. To your bill.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill simply directs appropriation of $500,000 per year to the clean energy resource teams. We do have the CIP program here in the state, which directs utilities. The Conservation Improvement Program directs the utilities to try to meet the measure of 1.5% of the energy that they produced. These clean energy resource teams are simply another tool that they use to accomplish that. And that's where we're directing the funds. I have with me members of that Clean Energy Resource Team to give a brief overview of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Briefly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lissa Polish, and I serve as the statewide search director for the University of Minnesota's Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships.
And I'm Diana McEwen. I'm the Metro CERT Director with Eureka Recycling. Thank you so much for this opportunity to testify before you on House File 1000, which renews and continues CERT's funding. The Clean Energy Resource Teams, or CERTS program, was launched in 2003 and is designed to connect people with the resources they need to identify and implement community-scale clean energy projects. The first handout you have provides an overview of your of our work and our value, but just briefly, we work to support any community as they do work to advance their own energy efficiency or renewable energy initiatives. We do it in a couple ways, by marshaling resources to support their on-the-ground efforts, helping them identify and draw upon other similar project models, successes, and best practices to move their efforts forward more quickly, and by making sure they benefit from others' lessons learned and avoid making same mistakes twice.
We work via 7 regional teams, and we provided you a map so that you can see how we look at the state. On the backside, you can actually see that each of these teams is led by local steering committee members, and you can see a listing of those members. These local steering committee members actually set forward our priorities. They say what are the issues that are pressing on the ground. They serve as technical resources in their communities, and they direct our seed grant funding. A few of the priorities that they've identified over the past year and many years beyond that have been energy efficiency. It's always a priority of things that we work with, and that is why our work aligns so well with this fund. They've also identified things like solar, wind, and biomass over the years, and we've been able to use these core dollars from the SIP R&D fund to both do our core on-the-ground work of working with people on the ground in their communities in terms of funding seed grant projects and catalyzing work, but we've also used this to leverage outside dollars, including dollars from federal funds like the USDA and private foundations like the Carolyn Foundation and Bush Foundation over the years to help spur our other work.
Very good. Thanks. Are there other questions or concerns for members of the, or anyone else who desires to testify? If not, the Representative Hoppe will renew his motion that House File 1000 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next up, Representative Slocum, you can do it right from there. Representative Slocum will move that House File 902 be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. Well, all right. You can. By the way, on behalf of our entire committee, Representative Slocum, welcome back.
Yeah.
We've missed you a great deal.
I'm trying.
Now make it quick, Slocum.
I will. It's terribly uncontroversial, and it's fairly quick. Mr. Chair, first off, I would like to move the delete all amendments.
It's my understanding the author's amendment is the 813-248. Representative Slocum will move the 813-0248. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Slocum, to your bill is amended.
Okay, I just wanted to start out by saying I was able to sit through a couple of non-controversial bills recently, and I was thinking as a teacher, I've spent over 600 hours to get a license renewed in my career. That's a lot of hours in in-service. And what this bill does is about cosmetologists, and I'm going to let you go ahead. And all it does is it very simply says to renew your license, you need to have 4 hours. It's a 3-year license, 4 hours of in-service on safety, health regulations, and the laws in Minnesota. And I have Mr. Hirsch to help me out here.
Okay, Mr. Hirsch, how about in a minute?
Very well, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Salon and Spa Association representing the cosmetologists in the state of Minnesota. Real briefly, as Representative Slocum laid out, this is a bill that would require all cosmetologists beginning August 1 of next year, 2014, that as a condition of renewal of their license, they must do 3 hours of continuing education in health, safety, sanitation, as well as 1 hour in cosmetology, law, and rule. I'm not aware of any opposition to this. This is a very good bill from the standpoint of both public safety as well as for the professionalism of cosmetologists statewide. I do have 2 cosmetologists standing by ready to testify in favor, but we can dispense with that if you so choose, Mr. Chair.
We just like them standing by in the event of an emergency question of some sort. Are there any questions or concerns? Member from Lyon.
Mr. Chair, just note, I think the main change would be in one bill it says 3 days, or 3 hours, and the other one says 4 hours. Is there a particular reason why that's being changed?
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Swedzinski, actually the original bill also called for 4 hours, but the original bill separated by 3 hours for health, safety, sanitation, plus 1 hour for state law and rule. The rewrite just combines it, but still specifies that three of the four must be health, safety, sanitation, and state law and rule.
A good clarification. Unless there's any further questions or anyone else desires to be testify, the Representative Slocum will renew her motion that House File 902 is amended, be recommended to pass, and be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, well, seeing one, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Slocum. Thank you, Mr. Hirsch. House File 1221.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Don't tell anybody, though.
Representative Dean will move that House File 1221 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. And for, I think, the first time, or maybe the second time today, I don't believe we have any amendments, Representative Zine. So it's a two-year bill, and unless you're aware of opposition, the more brief that you can be, the better we would, or the more we would appreciate it. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before you is Bill 1221. As mentioned, no amendments. And I have Peter Briquetti here, who's available for questions, should you have any of them. This is really a technical and housekeeping bill for some provisions that haven't been looked at for maybe 20 years or longer. So.
Yep, that's my understanding as well. Unless members have come up with questions in reading through the bill, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, can you speak to the real estate broker license fee portion of the bill?
Either Representative Dean or Mr. Briquetti, can you address that? What particular page are you on, Representative Anderson? I'm trying to find that.
Oh, shoot. I should have marked it. 3.4.
I'm sorry, 2.4?
3.4.
Page 3, line 4. Okay. Mr. Briquetti?
Mr. Chair, again, Peter Briquetti, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. Representative Anderson, that changes a typo in the statute. That fee has always been $20. It's also referenced in Chapter 82.57, Subdivision 1F, is $20. It's always been assessed as $20, and it was incorrectly listed as 10 in the statute, so we're correcting it here.
Representative Anderson?
When did that happen? And you said that you have been assessing the $20, even though the statute said 10.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, that's correct, because it's referenced in two places in the statute correctly, in 82.57, Subdivision 1F. I don't know when that was put into law. I could find out for you and report back to you after committee, but that is the case. And discuss it with the Realtors Association. They understood it and had no difficulty. That's why it's in the technical.
Okay.
Great, thank you.
Unless there's anything further, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 1221 be recommended to pass and referred to General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dean. Thank you, Representative Briquetti, or Mr. Briquetti for that matter. Representative Hortman moves House File 956 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Hortman, it's my understanding you have three authors' amendment. We will start with the A13-332 amendment. All in favor of the author's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Next is the A13-333 amendment. Again, an author's amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Next up is the A18 amendment. Again, an author's amendment. All in favor of the A18 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hortman, to your bill as amended.
Thank you,
Mr. And perhaps you can reference what the, I believe you've been working with some stakeholders on those three amendments. Perhaps you can walk through what the bill does and what those amendments did.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The House File 956 is the energy omnibus bill this year. The major objective is to kickstart the solar industry in Minnesota. We kickstarted the wind industry starting in 1994, and then again in 2007, and the way we did that was we provided a production incentive for wind energy, and we also provided a standard. Those two acts together drove the development of a very successful and thriving part of Minnesota's economy. We're hoping to do the same thing in the solar industry by putting in place a production incentive for solar energy and also setting a standard. It's a very achievable and reasonable standard of 0.5% by 2016, 2% by 2020, and 4% by 2025.
The amendment that we adopted, the A18 amendment, makes that standard applicable only to Minnesota's public utilities. It exempted all municipal associations and cooperative associations from the solar standard. What it did is it allowed them, if they would like to, by a vote of their boards, to enter into a state solar program where their customers would be allowed to get an incentive through a state fund that would be funded by $5 million from the Renewable Development Fund. We continue to work with stakeholders, and I suspect we'll have a few more changes going forward. There are other provisions in the bill that came out of the Energy Policy Committee. There's a provision for otter tail power that I keep wanting to say that Representative Kelly carried, but it was actually Representative McNamer's bill. And there was a bill for Excel relating to gas infrastructure, gas utility infrastructure, that was carried by Representative Seltzer. And there was a transmission rider carried by Representative Kelly. The A130333 had some technical changes to the transmission rider language. The A130332 had some changes to the gas utility infrastructure. Also contained in the A18 amendment was the deletion of the initially proposed funding mechanism for the solar energy production incentive. The original proposal was an assessment of 1.33% to fund the incentive payments. The A18 amendment removed the 1.33% assessment. What it did instead is it said for the utilities that are still governed by House File 956, they need to offer a program to their customers. So if their customers choose to enter the solar program, then they need to pay an incentive. And they're allowed to cap the size of their program at 1.33% of their prior year net revenue. Mr. Chair, I think those are the major provisions of the bill. I'm happy to take questions.
Well, and Representative Horton, I appreciate you walking through the policy elements of the bill. It's important to note for members to have their heads on right for this particular bill. In this capacity, we are sitting here as the Finance Committee. That's why you have before you the fiscal note. Policy questions are obviously for the Energy Committee as well as for the floor, certainly. And this is, I believe, going to Ways and Means. So if you have questions about the fiscal impact relative to the state agencies that are involved, this is certainly your opportunity to raise that. If you have policy concerns, the opportunity to do that is going to be on the floor at this point. Are there questions relative to the fiscal note or the fiscal impact? Are there others that desire to be? I'm told, Representative Hortman, that you've addressed. I had a couple people that wanted to testify, but you were working through some of their concerns and were trying to address them through the amendments, and I think that's occurred. But if there's others still desire to testify, now would be a good opportunity to talk about the fiscal impact on some of the agencies. If not, then Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and feel free to cut me off. This might not be strictly on the fiscal note, but I will make this point also on the floor, and I made it over the years on the solar energy and wind energy and other things, and I think it's important for all of us to remember on the floor that this is going to be borne, the cost of this, whether we like the program or not, the cost is going to be borne by the ratepayers of the state. For this committee's purposes, the cost of this is going to be borne by the business-paying ratepayers of the state of Minnesota. So setting the policy aside, whether you like it or not, I think it's incumbent upon all of us to remember that this stuff ain't free, and it's going to be costing all of our ratepayers more for their energy costs all over our great state.
And Representative Hoppe, obviously, I'm not going to cut you off. You're past chair. You're the lead on this committee. You get a little bit of latitude to make those sorts of comments, certainly. And but I'm guessing that will be a very healthy debate on the floor. And Representative Hortman is smiling, so I think she anticipates that same discussion. The member from Lyon, Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of a question. I had been visiting. I think you were able to negotiate out some of the local co-ops, and we appreciate that from this mandate. But I know my local school district was pretty concerned with the potential for this to go through and affect them from a school funding standpoint, and affect them from a school funding standpoint when it comes to utility bills. They sent quite a number of their bills and the dramatic increase they've seen over the last 10 years from some of the renewable standards that we have put in place. And just from a travel standpoint, is there any plans that this would go to Ed Finance to discover really kind of how this would affect our schools and local property taxes?
Speaking of outside the purview of this committee, but I get the question. Representative Hortman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swidzinski, just like any insurance bill that goes through this committee doesn't go to the Education Finance Committee to see the impact on a school district, no, this bill isn't planning to go through there. And I would guess that your school districts in your community are served by municipal power or cooperative power and so would no longer be impacted by the bill.
And Representative Anderson, and then Representative Woodard, and then I think we're going to try to vote, if that's all right. So, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hortman, I think Representative Swidzinski brings up a very good point. I have school districts that aren't served by a co-op or a municipal, and so obviously they would be impacted by this. But I'm more concerned, I'm not more concerned, but I'm equally concerned about, in looking at this fiscal note, we're just looking at the administrative costs of doing this, and I'm guessing that this does not include what the increased rate of energy will be as a cost to the state and just local units of government in general. I'm wondering if you have any fiscal data on that to see what their electrical rates will be after this is, if this is implemented.
Representative Hortman?
Representative Anderson, no, I don't have any information for you on that.
Representative Woodard?
Madam, or Mr.?
You mean on some topic before the Commerce Committee, Representative Anderson, or something
I just,
else?
As I've got it, I go for broke, so.
Representative Anderson.
I'm just hoping that maybe fiscal staff can get some data for us, if they have that maybe already.
And Representative Woodard.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure this one is fully in the purview. The amendment that we that you offered that we passed on exempting the munis and the co-ops, can you kind of walk through what the reasoning behind that was, you know, why we want to exempt those and then require the public utilities to follow the mandate?
Representative Portman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Size. There's a large variety of sizes for municipal power agencies and cooperatives. There are some that are very, very small. And in trying to apportion out for municipal power and cooperative power where you would be affecting the ones that were big enough, it's a fairly small group of municipal power groups and cooperatives that are large enough that we would want to impact. And so it was, from a drafting standpoint, cleaner to just leave them out entirely.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hortman will then renew her motion that House File 956 is amended to be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hortman. Thank you, members. That concludes our agenda. We stand adjourned.